head into the Ringerverse to stay up to date with all things superheroes and nerd culture entertainment. Hosted by a rotating lineup of superfans at The Ringer, including Mallory Rubin and Van Lathan, shows will provide instant reactions to blockbuster releases, insightful backstories on canon, and mind-bending theories, as well as fresh takes on the latest news and rumors. Check out The Ringerverse on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Empower. You got money questions like, can I retire early? What are my best savings options? Can I afford to pay for my kids' education? Luckily, Empower has all the answers. With Empower's real-time dashboard and real live conversations, you get clarity on your real-life financial goals. So join 18 million Americans and Empower what's next. Start today at empower.com. Tap the banner or visit this episode's page to learn more. Sponsored by Empower, not an endorsement or a statement of satisfaction by a client. This episode is brought to you by Max. The new HBO original limited series, The Sympathizer, is an espionage thriller and cross-culture satire that follows a communist spy during the final days of the Vietnam War and his new life as a refugee in Los Angeles. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr. and based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, The Sympathizer is streaming now exclusively on Max. Tap the banner or visit this episode's page to learn more.
I need support staff to clear the room.
Stand up and walk now.
Hello and welcome to The Watch. My name is Chris Ryan. I am an editor at TheRigger.com, and joining me on the other line, live from Nazaré, Portugal, it's Andy Greenwald.
Tow me up. Put me in a big wave.
Once you go big, you can't go home, man. What's going on, Andy? It's Monday. We are here to chat about popular culture. We got a big show today. We're going to be talking about the new Matt Damon film, newish Matt Damon film, Stillwater, which we both watched this weekend. We're going to be talking, oh yes, about 100 Foot Wave, which we kind of dabbled in last week. And Andy went on this journey with me. You know, It's been Surf City over in my house this summer. I just got done watching a Laird Hamilton documentary. Riding Giants is next. So we're going to talk a little surf, and we can do some news at the top. How are you doing?
Yeah. Oh, great, great. You know, I've reached the stage of my, I can't tell if it's my age, which is, you know, more or less our age, or my physical regimen, but I am now officially like, wow, that really loud noise came from me as I stood up off the couch years old.
Right.
And I do wonder, I mean, I know that I don't really do a good stretching regimen or whatever, but like with the amount that I'm going running in the world and then also like doing other things, like yesterday I came back from a 7-mile run and my family was like, let's go bike riding. I was like, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, bro. Absolutely. Like that's what I was made for. But then I also wonder then the flip side of it is, will I ever stop hurting again? So
here's something it's funny you should bring this up because, you know, I've been trying to get dialed out on the course again. I've been doing some rain sessions and
he's talking about golf.
And I've been trying to find my shot shape. I've been trying to, I hadn't played in a couple of months. So right. When I got back out on the range, like when I got home, because I didn't limber up, I hurt my back really bad. Like it was incredibly painful. And yesterday I was on the couch and watching the BMW Championships, an incredible final round matchup between Patrick Cantlay and Bryson DeChambeau. And I don't know if you know this about Patrick Cantlay or if you know who Patrick Cantlay is.
Never heard that name before.
Once fractured a vertebrae, a hairline fracture of his vertebrae. And now it takes him like 5 hours to like loosen up enough just to swing a golf club.
Totally.
And yesterday he played, I think, what it must have been like 25 holes because they had like a 6-hole playoff. So he already needs to like warm up for 5 hours before he can play golf for 5 hours. And I'm just like, I can't hit 30 balls at the Griffith Park driving range without having to be in traction. So it really does put you like you have to understand to do things at our age, you now really have to want to because you're going to pay for it.
Yes. I mean, this is, you asked me how I was doing on Friday and I was just like, well, Chris just had an hour long Pilates session and I can't feel anything south of my neck or north of my knees.
Yeah.
But I assume that there's a goal. You know what I mean? Like this is my version of, and this is going to come up again when we talk about big wave surfing. So buckle up. But I have to believe that there is a long-term purpose here. I just can't see it. Right. So that's why we do the things we do. Is it for televised greatness? Like the names of the golfers you mentioned, whom I don't remember.
Yeah, Patty no. Ice and the big golfer Bryson DeChambeau. No,
but it is to keep us limber and loose for the pop culture takes.
That's right. That's
that
right.
People want. That
that's
people
where
want
I.
From us.
That's where I put in the work. That's where I lift. That's where I get loose.
You do reps. I mean, that's the true. Other thing. Long-term fans of the podcast can probably tell days when you've already been in the gym / sitting in front of the microphone for hours before you sit down with me. You know what I mean?
I wanted to talk a little bit. Obviously, we're going to do Stillwater. We're going to talk about 100 Foot Wave. But there's a couple of things I wanted to touch on today. First of all,
yeah,
you know, lost a television legend this weekend, Ed Asner, who also yes. appeared in your show, Briar Patch. And I was just wondering if you'd like to share any remembrances of this giant of TV with our listeners.
There were a lot of people who listened during this time know, like, the entire experience was of making the TV show was totally surreal. But few things were more surreal than writing this part for an incredibly cranky old actor and our casting director, Susie Ferris, being like, well, what about Ed Asner? And I'm like, mm-hmm. well, no, that's when I say incredibly cranky old actor, like, that's obviously who I mean, but that's Lou Grant. Like,
yeah, right.
He's not. And God bless Ed Asner. Like, he was 89, I guess, at this point, or maybe 90. And he wanted to work. He loved to work. So he agreed to do the show, which was mind-blowing to me and to everyone else. I mean, like, the other thing about working with a total legend like that is, like, Jay Ferguson was losing his mind. I get to have a scene with Lou right. Grant, which is he loved those shows in the Mary Tyler Moore Show growing up. Or you have younger actors who know him from Elf or from The Voice in Up. And so he's just sort of this cross-generational legend. Or Rosario, who I think crossed paths with him once at some sort of a political gathering because mm-hmm. he was incredibly dedicated and committed to left-wing political causes his entire life and really, like, you know, walk the walk and just talk the talk. But, he, you know, he also was a total crank and a total character. He, early on when he agreed to do it, but before he arrived in Albuquerque, I got word that he wanted to talk to me. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh boy, okay. So I was like, you know, I got ready and got on the phone with him. And it was pretty clear immediately that what he had probably conveyed is that he wanted to talk to the boss. Right. And so someone put me on the phone, but he wanted Ishmael. He wanted Ishmael. And then I realized he wanted Sam because he wanted to pitch Sam on something after he was done with Briar Patch.
Oh, really?
So I was like, oh, Mr. Asner, no problem. And Sam was super geeked because then Ed Asner wanted to talk to him and pitch him on something. But then when he showed up, you know, he just wanted to work and play. And he was partnered with the great actor David Paymer in all their scenes. And David Paymer was a great sport because they just, especially for their first scene in episode 3, just kind of Statler and Waldorfed. And right. improv. So almost every line he has in that episode is improv.
Were you like Adam McKay, just like throwing lines from behind the camera, throwing jokes?
You know, I couldn't tell how much he wanted me to exist, let alone like be present that day. It was also like 100 degrees in Albuquerque. But my favorite moment
it was Albuquerque.
It was Albuquerque. He, I wrote a really, really long speech for him in episode 7, and he really wanted it. He was like, make it long. He's like, give me something. Give me something good. And I was like, yeah, and then also you're going to be yelling at Kim Dickens, calling her a cow and eating cottage cheese with a spork that's brought to you under a silver cloche. And he was like, fine. That's normal. That's fine. And this is the thing I shared online. It was my favorite memory of him was afterwards we took a picture, and that was his last day of shooting. He was only in, I think, 3 episodes. And he was like, how'd we do? And I was like, oh my God, Mr. Asner, like, I can't believe you did that scene. You were amazing. And I said some stuff and he just looked me in the face and he went, you always just good at lying out your ass. I mean, that's who that dude was. And I can't believe I got to work with him. And I, you know, 91 years old and he was still working. That was the other thing. If you go on IMDb, like, he just kept doing guest appearances and shows and he loved it. He really missed. And it was an honor to work with him.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty amazing that obviously you got to make a show. That's pretty amazing in and of itself. But
thanks,
the fact
pal.
That you did get to cross paths with, you know, somebody of his stature and somebody with his sort of institutional gravity in terms of like what he accomplished over the course of his life and his career is pretty amazing.
And my favorite moment when he came in after, the last time I saw him, he had to come in to do some ADR because like to fix some audio on some lines. So, you know, his assistant wheeled him in because he could walk, but he was mostly traveling by wheelchair. And, you know, put the headphones on him, and he's done this 1,000 times, and put the headphones on, like, can you redo the cough here and say this line here? And he nails it. And then when you do ADR, you're speaking into a microphone along with the footage, and then the mm-hmm. footage continued to the next scene. And it was just my favorite moment. He was just like, cough, get out of here, son, or whatever his line was. And then it switches to a different scene, and he just goes, well, look at the can on her. So you know what I mean? An old school Hollywood guy to the end.
You know, I wanted to ask you a little bit about one, the most notable TV story that sort of has popped up over the last couple of mm-hmm. days, because it's a show that you and I don't think either of us have watched, and we certainly haven't talked about, which is Manifest. It's an NBC show.
Writer's Room was next to the Briar Patch Writer's Room.
Oh, okay.
So clearly and, very connected to these guys.
Right. And this is a show that's been on for 3 seasons on NBC.
Yep.
It was announced, I think, last year that it was going to be canceled, that it was not going to complete.
Earlier this year.
Seems like last year. And so they announced that it was going to not come back on NBC. There was as there is for many shows, a brief save Manifest, like run where it's like they're talking to other streamers, they're talking to other networks, they're going to try and save it. A classic kind of like modern day TV story where you've got it. It's being aired on NBC, which has mm-hmm. its own streaming service. It's being made by Warner Brothers Television, and it is doing very well. Its reruns, or not reruns, but its second run is having a huge amount of success on Netflix, according yep. to Netflix. So the natural sort of landing place, if you will allow the pun for a show about a plane that goes up in the air and then lands 5 years later, was Netflix, because it was doing so well for that. But there, you know, there's all these complications. Netflix wants international rights. They had already sold the international rights for Manifest. Netflix wants this. They'd already kind of done that. And that's what happens when you have all these different cooks in the kitchen with a television show. And against all odds, they've sort of figured out all the business side logistics of this deal and are going to, in fact, bring Manifest back for a 4th season. 20 episodes. So mm-hmm. it'll likely be broken up, I would imagine, 10 and 10, knowing Netflix, but maybe there's some different order of the episodes, because I would imagine for a show like that, especially since the viewers are probably anticipating this new season, they want to create some kind of sense of anticipation, which is, I think, Netflix's major issue with its original programming now is, mm-hmm. you know, and what happens next week? And you can't get that. You can't get that because the diehards are just going to burn through it. Yep. And the conversation is going to kind of be all over the place. But this is a show with a really big fan community. What do you make of all this? Is this something that is sort of like a curio, or do you think it means something more than just like they've figured out a way to make the money work and this show found a landing spot?
I think it is probably more that than anything else. And I think that's the specific piece of this that I can't really speak to, because I don't really know what the money was or how it worked or what it means long term for the eventually 4 seasons of the show internationally, which you were right to point out is what drives a lot of Netflix's decision making. So in a way, I think this is kind of an old fashioned event and almost mm-hmm. a throwback. The idea of one studio making a successful show for a broadcast network that finds life on an unaffiliated to the other two companies streaming service, those days are coming to a halt. So in that sense, this is a very old media story. All the stuff that we remember from, like, I don't know, 2013 to 2018, when it was like, Netflix will give you another season. Netflix yeah. will save you.
Right.
That hasn't been happening much anymore, precisely because of those reasons. I mean, because the real value is owning something and having it locked up in your catalog forever. And it's not just that Netflix wants to do it. It's that Warner Brothers wants to silo its content on HBO Max and NBC wants to silo its content on Peacock. So mm-hmm. these worlds are becoming more and more separate. That said, I did think it was interesting and noteworthy because it's not as if Netflix is giving Manifest a new lease on life. They're giving Manifest a chance to finish the story. And I think that's the more interesting piece here. What they're doing is basically making a bet on having a absolutely established now in their own algorithms, bingeable, compelling show that is also done. That's the piece of it that is more contemporary Netflix.
That's very Netflix.
You know what I mean? Like, as we've talked about, one of the reasons why, one of the reasons why I feel like we're not talking about Netflix as much as we were a few years ago, other than in business stories, is because the ongoing shows that they make that we like and support are coming to ends, either ceremoniously or unceremoniously, in the case of Ozark and Glow, respectively. Mm-hmm. And the shows that they do make are much more, you know, closed circuit or international, right? Like a miniseries or they, you know, now we like call your agent or call my agent or whatever, seems to be doing very, very well for them. As someone who watched Until He Couldn't Anymore in season four, I don't think it's not particularly like clickbaity. Like there's nothing for us to cover there other than it was delightful and it was a nice diversion. So, but I think that Manifest speaks to something that has clearly proven to have value, which is that they have all of something that people want to go crazy for over a short period of time. And generally we've thought of that as they had 30 Rock and people would just like go ham on it. Or, you know, I think I've told the story before about how Lily Amirpour, who directed the Briar Patch pilot, very avant-garde, out there kind of visual mind, watched two episodes of Friends every night, no matter what, on Netflix. Yeah. Like that kind of completism. But the role of a show like Manifest is interesting to me, and the deal makes sense for all involved. What it made me wonder is, they must be behind the scenes, but I guess I was curious, maybe I'm not thinking of something, or maybe this is Cowboy Bebop, a show I don't really understand what it is yet, but why isn't Netflix more aggressively in the next Lost business? Do you know what I mean? Like, if they
I would imagine Dark was that. And I think Witcher, you know, was like kind of a next Game of Thrones. So are you asking why they don't have like a water cooler show that's set in contemporary times, or why they're doing such hard genre
specifically
stuff?
The Lost thing. Yeah. The thing about Lost and Manifest and all those other shows over the last decade plus that the broadcast networks have tried and failed to hit with, like The Event, you know, there are always these like light, not hard sci-fi, like
there's
soft
a show,
sci-fi.
I think NBC has one now called Debris that's about like, you know, remnants of a UFO that start giving people powers or something like that.
And that vibe has succeeded enormously in shows like Roswell, which I think is in its like 38th season on the CW right now. Mm-hmm. Though that space doesn't really work in broadcast television, because broadcast television model is, you know, we want to maximize this. So we want it to run for either one or 10 seasons, depending on what gives us the best return. But it's very hard to tell a multi-layered, complicated, forking story that way. Whereas if Netflix could say like, okay, you know, we're going to give you a 5-year window to do it, then they would have that 5-year content chip in their system. And that type of show has proven to be very successful. And I don't even know, there probably is an internal industry name for a show like that, but I just feel like Netflix has been so smart and rapacious in being like, people sure do love watching makeover shows. We will make all of them. They sure do love making baking shows. We control all of them.
Yeah.
That this is a sign that this is really, this type of show
still has
some legs.
Yeah, we have a huge footprint in the sports documentary world now.
Right.
We, you know, they've tried and then stopped seemingly making studio sitcoms, like basically, multicam sitcoms on sets. You know, I think that we talked about that a few months ago, where it was interesting that they were seemingly getting out of that business. You know, I think that for something specifically like Manifest, from what I understand of it, and I understand like watching recap videos to get rid of this, ready for this podcast, but I would imagine
that's
something
your
5-hour
of golf swings, by the way.
That is impressive. That's right. It's me getting limbered. Something like that must have a lot tied up in the week-to-week kind of conversation around an episode and where something is going. Now, it may have found its popularity because of binging and because people were like scrolling around on the main screen for, oh yeah, let me check this out. Oh my God, I'm hooked and there's three seasons of this to watch. But to do something new, I do think that, you know, we've had this conversation in 100,000 different ways, but like, does Mayor of Easttown work on Netflix? If it's the same exact show, and then you wind up having, oh, well, I watched it yesterday, or we loved it. We crushed it in 2 days. But some people are like, hey, I'm finding this Mayor of Easttown show. That's pretty good.
I think you've nailed it on two fronts. One is the delivery system and how it's appreciated and absorbed and enjoyed. But the other thing is just simply the risk. Netflix, as a tech company, is risk averse. They took big swings early to establish themselves, but now that they have success and algorithms and blah, 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 they are risk averse. They're not going to make a Reservation Dogs, you know, and take a flyer on Sterling Harjo and Taika's Guidance and blah, blah, blah. It doesn't make sense for them to do that. The thing about Manifest is, as I was just saying, you know, we have 10, 12 years of people trying to do a Lost knockoff, and very few of them have worked. Some have had some commercial acclaim or critical acclaim, but rarely both. And the thing about a show like that is, it's a big bet. It's a big bet that you're going to have a show that has such a great question, in this case. What happened to a plane for 5 years? And you don't know how long or how stretchable that concept is. So to your point, Netflix stepped in. Netflix would never have made that pilot, I guess is what I'm saying and what I'm realizing. What they want is, oh, it worked. and people want to watch it the way we can give it to them. So this works out for us. We can lay in wait, let someone else, in this case, Warner Brothers and NBC, take the big bet, and we ultimately end up winning. I think that's probably the strategic decision-making behind it and why they have an international division and a non-scripted division, but they don't have a soft sci-fi, crowd-pleasing, open-ended drama division.
Yeah, and I wonder whether or not, because if you start to think algorithmically, which I imagine Netflix obviously does, and I think you could make the argument to some extent Amazon does, although I sometimes feel like they have some of that older school studio sensibility mm-hmm. about the shows that they pick and the people that they want to be in business with. When you get into kind of atomizing their shows, if you think about Lost, Lost was a pretty diverse, relatively diverse cast.
For the time, yeah.
And it was made with mass appeal in mind. You know what I mean? Like there was even down to its genre influences, those things, like whether it was Flann O'Brien novels or, you know, the Bible or things that were baked into it, those things were so subterranean in its influences that really what you had was a ensemble drama with a huge mystery. And when you look at something like, say, The Wilds, which is on Amazon and is about a group of teenage girls going on what they think is a retreat and then wind up being in a plane crash and being stranded on an island, seemingly in the South Pacific, that's like very specifically targeted to, if not YA, but especially like teenage girls and people who think about like the sort of issues of teenage girls. Like it's like almost a micro targeted advertisement within the show of like, we know exactly who we want to watch, who we want watching the show. And if we get other people, great, but this is going to have a baseline, like a floor of the people who buy these kinds of angsty adventure YA novels. And that's not really what the networks have ever kind of done. They've never been like, we're going to make a play for this sliver of an audience. And we think that sliver is big enough. But the reverse is true. Netflix doesn't do that. Netflix doesn't make kind of generic dramas.
And I think it's a good point that you made also about Amazon's role in this. What's fascinating to me is Amazon and Netflix, their scripted divisions are, I mean, the org chart is different, but they're both more or less led by women who are veterans of NBC Universal, where Bela Bajaria ran Universal TV for many years and is now at Netflix. And Jennifer Salke is at Amazon. She ran, or was the number two, and then very high up at NBC for many years. I thought it was interesting the other day at the upfronts, you know, where the executives present their slate, I guess still virtually, to the media, to journalists, that Jen Salke from Amazon was like, yeah, I regret missing out on Mare of Easttown, meaning Amazon mm-hmm. was bidding for that show.
Yeah.
Which I thought that in itself was kind of noteworthy and interesting. You know, feel free, Brad Inglesby, to call back into our show anytime, or Kate, because I assume she's still listening, and tell us I'm wrong. But I bet Netflix didn't bid on it because I don't see what it does for them, right? And we very much know what it does for HBO. It's been huge. It's driven subscriptions to HBO Max. It's burnished its brand as the place for week-to-week conversational TV and like awards bait, et cetera, et cetera. Amazon, I guess, still, maybe it's because its business remains all of the rest of what it does. Its TV department is still kind of I guess it's being run a little bit like both, right? Mm-hmm. It has we talked about this the other week. They're like $500 million for all the sci-fi stuff. But here, we wish we could have given you this, you know, this prestige-y crime procedural. And also, Donald Glover and Phoebe Waller-Bridge, like, this is your creative home.
We're going to do another season of Modern Love. You know, yeah, exactly.
Kind of caught between them. And I guess all of this is to say our understanding of what Netflix is in terms of a creative entity still very much in flux.
Yeah, that's a good place to stop. Why don't we take a quick break and we'll come back and we'll talk about Stillwater and 100 Foot Wave.
The opposite of Stillwater.
This episode is brought to you by Mint Mobile. If you've had it with your overpriced wireless plan with its insanely high monthly bill and unexpected overages, then listen to this. For a limited time, wireless plans from Mint Mobile are $15 a month when you purchase a three-month plan. That's unlimited talk, text, and data for $15 a month. Wow, right? To get this new customer offer, just go to mintmobile.com/watch. That's mintmobile.com/watch. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for more details.
Sweat. You mean armpit tears of weakness brought about by poor deodorant choices? Say goodbye to that salty river that floweth from your underarm with Old Spice Swagger Antiperspirant. Made for 24/7 sweat protection with daily use and an undeniable smell of cedarwood and lime. Giving you the confidence you need to quit your job, move to a remote island, and spend your days frolicking with dolphins. Old Spice Swagger Antiperspirant. Shop Old Spice now.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You might say all kinds of stuff when things go wrong, but these are the words you really need to remember. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. They've got options to fit your unique insurance needs, meaning you can talk to your agent to choose the coverage you need, have coverage options to protect the things you value most, file a claim right on the State Farm mobile app, and even reach a real person when you need to talk to someone. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Elevate every morning with Tommy John's Second Skin underwear. The luxurious support of Second Skin guarantees everything will go smoothly. With over 20 million pairs sold and thousands of five-star reviews, guys love Tommy John. Plus, your most valuable assets are covered with Tommy John's best pair you'll ever wear or its free guarantee. Get 20% off your first order at TommyJohn.com/Spotify. Save 20% at TommyJohn.com/Spotify. See site for details.
All right, man, we are back. Andy, it's been a long time, I feel like, since we talked about a new movie that wasn't like a Marvel thing or like, you know, kind of like a blockbuster genre thing. This is like in a lot of ways, a throwback to the kind of movies that you and I grew up watching in the 90s. It is a film from Tom McCarthy starring Matt Damon and Call My Agents, Camille Cotton. And it is a film set in both Oklahoma and Marseille. I think people are probably pretty familiar with the setup by now, mostly because this movie has not gotten what I would call great press terms of both its relationship to the Amanda Knox story and also some of the reviews. And it was interesting to go into watching this film with that in mind. I've been thinking a lot about my own sort of sense of expectations about things. Mm-hmm. And, you know, once you get out of the window of this better be fucking good because movies are dying, like you wind up actually maybe greeting things a little bit on its own terms. I've been thinking about that with a couple of movies that I've been sort of just kind of going back to on cable when I'm just like sitting around while sports aren't on. But for this one, I went into this and you know, I was like, I expected to sort of be, I don't know, disappointed by this movie. And I'm having like a very, very, very strange reaction to it, which is essentially that I don't know, and we're going to talk about this film with spoilers. So if you haven't seen Stillwater, by all means, skip ahead to the 100-foot wave or go have a lovely Monday afternoon.
Or go safely to a theater or rent it at home.
Yes.
You can watch it at home.
That's where both of us watched it. What do you do when you pretty much love something for 2/3 of it?
Yeah.
And the last third is so flawed that it makes you go back and revisit, like basically reconsider everything that you saw up into the final 15 to 20 minutes of the movie, maybe 30.
Totally. Well, so let me, before answering that, just so people who aren't familiar, Matt Damon plays a roughneck from Oklahoma who's traveling to Marseille because his college-age daughter has been imprisoned there for murdering her roommate. He becomes involved in a sort of quixotic, ill-advised potentially quest to free her name, but the movie goes into some surprising directions from there.
Very surprising.
Before beginning, I don't know if I entirely agree with you, but I also completely understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
And I don't know if this is even, is this a paternalistic way to like view movie or culture, but I enjoyed this and the experience of watching it so much. And I think one of the reasons that I did is not just because I think Tom McCarthy is a really just excellent humanistic filmmaker. I you know, Spotlight is his best known movie, but I love The Station Agent, and I especially love a movie he made called The Visitor with Richard Jenkins. I really think people should check it out.
He made Win Win too, right?
And he made Win Win, another terrific sort of small quote unquote movie. What I really there are two things that I deeply loved and admired about this movie before we even get into, like, I think Matt Damon is just blacks out. I think he's so good in this. I think there's so many specific things we can talk about. But the way that I was appreciating the movie, just whole cloth, is I think that it tries to do something so hard. And it takes something that I think most rational-minded creative people almost want to run away from, which is, let's make a movie about talking to Red State America or Red Hat America. Let's make a movie about America's role in the world in the Trump era or after the Trump era. Let's try this. And let's also try to give it, you know, some stakes and, you know, stuff that make it a movie. And also keep it within the relatively reduced purview of what Tom McCarthy's interested in, which is human beings behaving like human beings. He doesn't do, this isn't Taken, right?
Sure.
And what struck me again and again in watching the movie is that it was such a good faith effort to do that. I don't mean to say that I'm grading the movie on a curve, but I felt that it admirably and honestly wrestled with who it wanted its characters to be, what they represented, what they portrayed, ways to upend that, and to try to get at something that is very uncomfortable to think about or talk about, I think, for a lot of us at the moment. And that is what, I, you know, not to sound super corny, but I feel like that's what movies are supposed to do. And I found that very, I was very inspired by that. And the second piece of that, just from a purely structural level, listen, Chris, you know, nobody loves Letterboxd more than me. You know what I mean? Like, I am a cinephile with a capital cine.
Sure.
Like, that's just me.
Your username is Lord of the Skies, where you do most of your cinema watching. Yeah,
it is. It is, yeah.
The smaller the screen, the better, baby.
The higher the elevation and the higher the blood alcohol level, the more I will love feature films. But one thing that I have been enjoying over the last year, and we've talked about this a little bit, is I've been doing a lot of, like, Criterion Channel crushing and enjoying movies, really loving movies that I've been seeing and looking backwards and exploring a lot of classic films, et cetera. And one of the things that I love about them is I just think that fundamentally they're so different than TV shows. And maybe this is the TV writing part of me that is taking refuge in movies is, you know, they have to be broader because you can't digress into this person's subplot or the character or the arc, character arc, or the season that's about this. You have to choose the stakes for your story and then execute at such a high level because you're doing the beginning, middle, and end. And when I say that, it sounds like I'm saying I like movies because they're predictable, but not like in a Robert McKee screenwriting convention, don't save the cat kind of thing. It's just that, well, we're running out of time, so now we have to do this turn and this twist, and this is the movie we're going to say. So this is the movie we're trying to make. What I loved about Stillwater, on top of everything else, was this movie did not go to the beat of any other drummer. This movie does not follow anything close to a linear path. It zigs and zags and becomes three or four different movies in a way that I think is incredibly difficult to pull off. And I think it almost pulled off.
Yeah.
And I loved that it was a movie, not a TV show. That the moment when, like, the humanization of our lead, where he sort of has this idol in France and becomes a different person, and it's romantic and sweet and family-centered and fun. Like, that wasn't a bottle episode. That was still in this relatively tight two-hour movie, and I loved the looseness in something that is normally so tight.
So you go into this movie, and there, like, what Andy is describing is essentially, like, I think the middle act of this film turns into Damon's character, Bill Baker, falling in with and then falling in love with Camille Cotton's character, Virginie. So this is single mother who's a theater actress with a daughter named Maya, and they live in an apartment in Marseille, and through, like, happenstance, like, he kind of meets them, then she helps him out with the sort of initial stages of the investigation, or his own investigation into who may have actually killed this character, Lena. And then there's something that happens in the middle of the movie where he basically takes, like, a long break from interacting with his daughter, and he pretty much just starts a surrogate family with Virginie and Maya. And there's, like, a whole episode of this movie, which is just basically, like, his day-to-day. He has a construction job, and, like, this is what he does at his construction job, but then he goes home and he makes hamburgers and
he's a babysitter.
He's found a family. And he's not only found a family, I think he's, like, The thing that I loved about the movie was that there was no false transformation of a character. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not like he gets to the end of the movie and he's now all of a sudden like reading Sartre or, you know, going to see Brecht plays or, you know, conversing with people in a cafe. He's still a roughneck, but I think he had a part of his heart like opened up because he got to experience a different kind of life than he had lived up until then. And it's a guy who's got addiction issues and rage issues. But essentially, like, I thought that that whole part of the movie was brilliant. And the reason why I think you're reacting to it being like, oh, this was so refreshingly a movie is because McCarthy is a very good writer. And so much of the exposition in this movie is so economically doled out. Like, there's a moment early in the film when they're still in Oklahoma and Bill goes to an older woman named Sharon's house, and he just goes and has dinner, and they have like an exchange, and you find out that Bill doesn't really talk to his own mother. You find out that Sharon, who's Allison's grandmother, it's his mother-in-law, and you just wind up learning so much about this family in a really natural, very real feeling conversation between these two people without it ever being like, let's do a data dump. Let's do a reading of resumes. Let's do a reading of family history. I just thought that was remarkable. And that gets repeated multiple times throughout the film where you find out all this stuff about Camille Catan's family or her life and what her relationship to the father of her child is and what she thinks about theater. But it all feels very much like it's emanating from a very lived in natural place, no more so than the film's capturing of fucking Marseille, which is unbelievable. It is an unbelievably transporting movie. And I mean, obviously travel has been pretty limited, but like to be that immersed in a city, which frankly does not get enough time on screen in cinema or in TV, because it's so evocative. It's so interesting to look at, so textural. That I just found myself really, really falling in love with the people and the place and the story and everything. And I was really, really caught up in it. And then it has this third act that I think most people are having a hard time wrapping their minds around.
I think I love what you're saying about the way, I mean, Tom McCarthy, I think the thing that I find compelling about him is that he just really loves people and he loves people talking. And to listen to him on some other interviews and other podcasts, and he does have a process. I mean, he does almost reportage. Like, he wants to go to Oklahoma and talks to people. You know, he didn't feel like he was capturing Marseille correctly, so he brought on some French collaborators to work on the screenplay, people who had worked with the director Jacques Audiard, who we've talked about recently
from
in his
Bureau,
role
yeah.
of finishing The Bureau. I think that that's just an underrepresented style of filmmaking in general, and I always really get excited about it. I think that he and Matt Damon really committed to creating a whole person, which is challenging about someone who in many ways could be a walking stereotype, doubly so when walking around France in his jeans and his trucker cap. But to your point, someone who has depth and pain, you know, and also a way of being that it's easy to be, you know, sitting on the coast and be judgmental about, but also the performance and the writing and the filmmaking allows us a window, right? Which I think is what storytelling does at its best. I think ultimately the reason why, I know we're going to talk about the whole movie, we could talk about the specific choices at the end where Bill takes certain actions that result in what he thought he wanted happening, but maybe not to the way that he thought. It doesn't go the way he thought. The thing that I can't get over about the movie that I found really impactful was what it kind of had to say about American exceptionalism, and not necessarily in the way that we normally see it. Because the one constant that the one thing that you learn about Bill is that we see his existence and the pain that he's gone through and the sort of furrow he's worked himself into, just working the same sorts of jobs and then eating, you know, takeout hot dogs or Subway sandwiches and sleeping on his couch watching TV and waking up again. And the thing about living in the middle of a country like America is you can do that. It's not saying it's a choice. But the exceptional ability to just be barricaded in this place, basically. And then when he goes to Marseille and is opened up to so many other things, and then there's the sort of extrajudicial aspect of it. It's not just the American cowboy thing, but that literally justice is changed, right? And it's ambiguous about how we should feel about that. But all of this stuff that can happen over there, it's undone in a very American way. And then at the end of it, he's back. And, you know, What did he learn? What did he gain from it? What's still out there? That sense of being closed off here.
Yeah. You know, I mean, the way to put a bow on it would be to say, like, he gets everything he thought he wanted and lost everything he actually needed. You know,
life is brutal, as they say in the movie.
Yeah. And it's said twice, you know, once by Allison in the middle of the movie, mm-hmm. when she's experiencing this one moment of freedom and is thinking she probably won't, you know, ever get back her life. And then again by Bill at the end of the movie, after he has, you know, just avoided going to jail himself and has pulled some really questionable shit, he is almost saying life is brutal wistfully. Like, he's saying that, like, I think I'm opening myself up to the, like, possibility of happiness and the also attendant heartbreak or disappointment that goes along with losing something that made mm-hmm. you happy. And, you know, I mean, that I thought that the very final scene of the movie was quite moving.
Does this feel old fashioned to you that we're talking about a movie that may or may not have, quote unquote, stuck the landing, that may not, that absolutely without question isn't a masterpiece? I mean, it's not perfect. It's not mm-hmm. all good even, but that, you know, there's it's rich enough to have a conversation like that. I think this idea that it needs to get it right, or it needs to, you know, be correct about everything, whether it's plotting or its view of Americans or et cetera, you know, it's such an exhausting way to filter this stuff. So I'm just relishing that we both watched this like a few weeks after. I mean, it wasn't really in the spotlight, but a few weeks after it came out, and there's just a lot to unpack here.
Yeah, I think that. Yeah, I mean, should we talk about the sort of last act? I mean, because maybe just think a lot about manipulation. So over the course of the movie, especially in the second act, Bill develops this very close relationship with this kid, Maya, Virginia's daughter, Maya. They have like this really adorable relationship where she's teaching him French words and he's teaching her English words, and he picks her up every day after school and helps her with her homework. And it's just,
she likes ketchup now.
It's quite touching, honestly. And the kind of movie turns when they go to a Marseille football match. Incredible. They shot it at the Velodrome. It's just fucking electric. And he sees this guy who he believes is the actual killer of this girl, Lena, who is mm-hmm. his daughter is currently serving time for having murdered. And he endangers Maya quite a bit in his pursuit of this guy.
Yeah.
And goes on to kidnap him and keep him in a basement in the building where he lives with Virginia and Maya. And I could just feel like the like temperature change in the room when I was watching that. Like, both, I was watching it with my wife Phoebe. We were both just like, what the fuck? But not like, what the fuck in a, this is so Hitchcockian. Like, this is so interesting and gripping.
Full disclosure, my wife got up and left at that point and did not finish the movie.
Because she was like, this is revolting or what?
It was the kid endangerment.
Sure.
You know, and I was very uncomfortable with that turn at the moment. I then thought more about it after watching the movie, and I was like, this movie isn't that movie. But the fact that, in retrospect, this was not a movie that was about putting the child in physical jeopardy. It was more about the emotional, you know, choices that he was making, et cetera, and the effect that it would have later, blah, blah, blah. It's probably a flaw of the filmmaking that all of our minds went to that place. That jumped the rails a little bit.
It's a question about, you know, when you're watching a movie character, I think you take, you're omniscient. You know, whenever that character is on screen, you get to see everything.
Yeah.
So you think that you know this person by a certain point in the movie. I'm just speaking from a perspective of the audience. And then when you see them do something, not only that, like, is horrifying, but is also like really disorienting to your orientation towards the character. You know, you're like, I know that this guy isn't perfect, and I know that this guy probably has like some rugged shit from his past, mm-hmm. but it seems strange that he would do this, even if it meant like losing his sight of this guy. You know what I mean? Like, it seems mm-hmm. like the extremity and the sort of almost pulpy nature of it, I guess in some ways, maybe Tom McCarthy would say it is pulpy. It is kind of a little bit of a crime thriller at the end there. That's the turn I wanted to make. I wanted to give it a kind of a jolt of electricity and uncertainty, because otherwise it would be a fairy tale. It would be like this, you know, it'd be Beauty and the Beast in Marseille, and this guy finds like a second life. And, you know, I don't really know what the resolution would have been otherwise, but there was something about the nature of what he does, and then the way that it kind of is, you know, I know this guy just makes a lot of mistakes and he's always trying to sort of dig himself out of trouble throughout his life, but it's something about it really rang false to me.
I think the thing that I kept coming back to was what the movie was suggesting about the bonds or the bonds that can almost feel like chains that can drag us down, you know, and his constant belief that he needed to atone for things and make up for things and be the father that he wasn't to Allison and thus have a relationship with Allison that he couldn't and thus fix something for her, right? Like that's baked into who the character is when he first shows up and gives the lawyer the letter and then they leave it alone. But he tells Allison that it's all going great. In that moment, it's this kind of awful thing where he kind of chooses nature over nurture, right? Like he chooses this quixotic quest to like fix his birth daughter's relationship and sacrifices his chance to get it right, you know, his happier relationship for it. The actual plot was supporting that emotional turn. Mm-hmm. But I agree with you that it's a leap. It's a leap. And, you know, and there are a number of them in the movie. I mean, you have to accept that he just fundamentally will never involve the police, even though time and time again, it seems like that would help Allison.
Sure.
If he were to do that. You kind of have to believe that he's going to just see one person in a crowd of 70,000 at a soccer match, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, there are a lot of things that do. It is one of those things where, and this is often the case, I think, where something is very ambitious thematically and wants to be about something that, once those dots are set in the firmament, in the sky, like stars, then connecting them becomes, it can stretch, it can
sure.
pull. So
sure.
the TikTok of the story does start to come apart despite a lot of work on it. I agree with you. And there's no question that when that moment happens, I was like, I started to lean out instead of lean in.
Mm-hmm.
But then it gets to a place, like you were saying, in the last moment, where like, oh, okay, I see what this was for. What
yeah.
it was worth. And I mean, Damon, man. Damon's yeah. so good.
Yeah, I mean, Sean and Amanda had a short chat about this movie on their pod on Friday, and I thought, you know, they didn't really get too into the details of it, but they talked about some of their difficulty sort of just being like, that's Jason Bourne. Like, it's just
yes.
really hard to get over it. And there is a fight scene where I was just like, he's going to kill all these guys. And
he didn't
like,
have any magazines.
It was like him versus 11 dudes. And I was like, these dudes are in trouble. but yeah, like, I think it's a remarkable performance. And I think specifically it's remarkable because they never give this guy a moment where all of a sudden, like, there's this flowering of intellect or this outpouring of emotion. Like, he always keeps it in.
There's just a moment when, like, Virginie makes, like, a casserole with tomatoes and he eats that instead of a hamburger. And you're like,
right.
oh, my God, anything is possible. We can all change.
That's right.
This might be the only Venn diagram. The Venn diagram of this point observation might only be our podcast. But it was a little trippy to watch Stillwater the same weekend I finished the Netflix series The Chair, both of which are about, pill, either in the past or present, pill-popping, troubled white men named Bill who
uh-huh.
develop very intense and beautiful babysitter relationships with single mom's daughters.
Uh-huh.
That's true of both of those works. And those are probably the best parts
right.
of both of them. And that was a little confusing at times.
Oh, I thought you were going to say like the Chris Ryan, like the Ward movement is really happening.
You see yourself in the Bills. That's nice. You know, if you ever want to take my younger daughter out for hamburgers, like you are welcome. It's a different direction than what we've been describing, which has really been more of like a, you know, like a Hoosiers type thing.
Uh-huh.
That's not exactly what I'm offering you. But if you'd like to have something more similar to what we're talking about.
Right. Just as long as I stay away from any extra judicial investigations.
And circuit breakers. Like,
yeah.
I don't think that you should necessarily be redoing the electrical grid in my home.
Sure.
But otherwise, if you just want to like figure out different words for hammers and screwdrivers. Yeah, sure.
Let's talk about 100 Foot Wave.
Yes.
So I got to talk a little bit about this, obviously, at length with you before. So I want you to lead this one. This has been like a real revelation for me, just like this like late summer burst of interest in surfing. I've got Barbarian Days over here. I'm just like really jumping in with 2 feet. I'm so happy that you loved this show. Tell me, or show, series. Tell me a little bit about about what you were thinking as you were going through the rest of these episodes.
I'm so grateful to you for making this recommendation.
Be grateful to Phoebe. She was the one who found it.
I'm always grateful to Phoebe. I loved this so much, and it was exactly what I needed. And I loved it in ways that totally surprised me. I also think, and we can talk about this, you and I have both seen the entirety of the series. It's actually now the entirety of the first season, because they're going to bring the show back, which will be, you know, which is worth discussing. In many ways, it's multiple shows in one, mm-hmm. because in the first two episodes, you know, there's so much. It's recent history, but it's still history. Like, I did not understand the difference between paddle surfing and toe surfing, and the stakes that have been raised with big waves, and who these cast of characters were, and then sort of getting up almost to the present day, learning about this place, Nazaré in Portugal, and what it means, and how the communities embrace it or not. And then there's the middle episodes, which are just about people getting fucking broken and crushed. Yes. And then in the end, it's kind of just like a almost cinema verite documentary, because every second of these people's lives have been filmed, and it takes us right up to almost last month, and it's like pandemic-y. Yeah. And then we're like, oh, now I see that this is the bones of a series about these very interesting, again, broken in some senses, characters seeking this kind of spiritual and athletic redemption. So it's many things at once. But I want to start by saying, I felt the most intense kinship, isn't the word, because while I have recently made the change in my life that I am now someone who jumps into swimming pools and doesn't just sort of dick around on the steps for a while being like, ooh, that's cold.
Yeah.
And I feel like in that sense, I am not unlike CJ, his first time at Nazaré, who's just like, sure, bro, tow me up. Like, I do think that we have that in ourselves.
Yes.
I did text you like 45 minutes into the first episode with, you know, I don't usually like to make assertions without evidence. I mean, this is a very fact-based podcast, but yeah. I feel confident when I say
you also give things a fair shot. Like, you're always like, I'm going to wait till I get to the end
whole
of this
thing.
Yeah.
Who am I to jump in now? Unless it's a swimming pool, in which case I will jump in. I think there never has been, and there never will be, a Jewish big wave surfer. I feel very confident in that. Just culturally, neurotically, everything in my body is screaming, that's just not possible. And that, I think, ultimately is why I love this so much. Because, I mean, I don't even know how deep we're going to get in the ocean here. But, like, just purely on a spiritual / emotional level, for these people to be like, yep, take me into that red spot on the satellite map with a jet ski, and I will let go of the rope, and I will do that. It really resonated with me. I found it really compelling. Obviously, it's beautiful to look at, but I found it really, really moving.
Yeah, you know, so there's so many things that I loved about this. One of it was just, it's obviously filmed over the course of about 10 years. Mm-hmm. I believe they start, basically, the footage starts in 2011. So you get to see the characters age, and you get to see them go through some pretty significant life changes. Like we said before, Chris Smith, who made American Movie and worked on Tiger King, is the director of this. And, you know, I don't know the ins and outs of how they acquired all this footage, or whether he shot all of it, or some of it was self-produced by the McNamara family, which is the
I think it's more likely that. Yeah.
Yeah. And they have footage of basically everything from the start of 2011 to through the pandemic in 2020 or 2021. And so you kind of see not only this guy, Garrett, who even when the movie starts or the show starts, he's aging. He's an aging surfer. To now, when you're like, this is a bad idea for you to do this, man. Like, you have kids and you've suffered some really, really, really scary injuries. And you can tell.
In your mid-50s.
But you can tell that it's like, there's like, existence is not as like technicolor when he is not out on that wave. And they do a really good job of somehow communicating what that must be, that experience must be like, is if you are somebody who can tame the untamable or mm-hmm. can survive the unsurvivable, that then like barbecues and ball games, to steal something from Heat, just don't really hit, they hit different, you know, like you, and over again, you see this guy be like, you know, I've been told like, if I screw this up again, I won't be able to walk anymore. Or like my mm-hmm. shoulder almost just got like shredded. I really have to think about life. Like, I have like kids now and me and Nicole. And then like 10 minutes later, he's just like, I saw that fucking wave. And I'm just like, I'm about to get out there.
It's again, this is probably on some level, whether it was conscious or not, why we began our show today talking about how our aging bodies hurt, but there's something that is very, very compelling about the fact that the protagonists of this are not the young bucks.
Uh-huh.
Late in the series, you meet people who, I guess if you're a surfing fan, you would know about, and they would be household names, like the guy Kai Lenny, you know, like these young kids who suddenly show up in Nazare, and they are literally doing video game things. Like, our understanding as a complete
person
like who doesn't...
flips and 360s,
On the waves that up to now, as someone who had never heard about any of this, I see, you know, Garrett do this wave, or Justine, or some of the other people that we've met at this point, and it just seems like just getting on it and riding it to completion feels Herculean. These younger guys get on it, and they're just doing like sick 360s, like they're playing cool Borders on their PlayStation, like it's nothing. And that is awesome to look at. But what's more fascinating and it just resonates on such a deeper level is just Garrett's lifelong quest to have this Zen communion with the impossible. And Kadi, who becomes, you know, either the second or third most compelling character in the show, depending on your power rankings, which we should get into, you know, just seems like the most charming, lovable English guy who also has a family at home. And we meet him when he's just like some young kid who's like, I can't believe Garrett McNamara wants me to drive a jet ski.
Tow him
for
out
him.
Until the middle
and
of
And it's only because we were in Ireland and England and we were nearby, to being a grizzled veteran himself who had broken his back there. And we feel the pathos of it. He's still getting something from this, but the effort and the training and then just the
that
the
whole portrait of Kadi is amazing, because he basically starts as like Garrett's assistant.
Padawan, yeah.
And then right when he would sort of naturally kind of ascend in that whole world, he gets A, very badly injured, and also B, the entire world wakes up to the possibilities of Nazare. And so you start getting all these people coming in, and there's obviously growing pains with that, which is incredible. Like when they're like, yo, like the safety precautions aren't right here, or like guys are just like kind of doing it without the proper training. But it's almost as if the surfing community passes Kadi by a little bit, because you've got these guys like Kai who are like, I can just grind this out. Like, I'm just like, he's basically like Tiger Woods of surfing. And Kadi's like, fuck, man. Like, I would love to get, I would love to get like some recognition, some accolade, some one time in the spotlight. And he's either been in Garrett's shadow or the shadow of the guys who've come after Garrett.
Oh, the one time he won anything, it was for the wipeout that broke his back.
Right.
Which he has to carry around like an albatross, because that's what people remember him
They're
for.
They're like, oh, yeah, you're the guy who did this. Yeah, right, right.
And then, because I need to go here, my favorite television character of 2021 is CJ. So, for you know, I think people know, but we'll just go over it briefly. Like, Garrett has already had a career as a surfer, retired, learned about tow surfing, which in which he is, you know, you don't paddle out, you are towed via jet ski out to the really, really big waves behind the what previously had been the big waves, and becomes this almost like, you know, monk kamikaze pilot of these waves. He also then falls in love with his second wife, starts a new family eventually. This is a woman named Nicole. You and I are big fans of Nicole. Great arc throughout the series. And she's just with him in Portugal as they build this, and she's his manager, and they build this whole new identity around this whole new surf spot together. Early on, we also meet Nicole's brother.
Yeah.
CJ.
Yep.
And I just, like, again, I don't even know how to, like, I have a cousin whom I love very much, and she married a wonderful guy who's a goy from Long Island, okay? And my favorite family members are him and his family.
Okay.
They are could not be less like me, and that's why I love them so much. Like, his dad, who's a pipe fitter his whole life, has a framed picture in his kitchen, framed, like, etching, and it says, it is what it is. And I was like, oh, my God.
Was this
I've lived
before
my
or
whole
after
life.
The Irishman?
Years, decades. And I'm like, no Jewish family has ever said it is what it is, because it never is. It's always more. So there is something, I don't mean to be like, I just find that very beautiful and inspiring and as alien as watching a science fiction movie to me. And so CJ, there's this moment where they're like, we're in Portugal. And so we called CJ. Okay, what was CJ doing, her kid brother? Well, he was playing professional beach volleyball elsewhere in Europe. And he came down to Nazare.
In Malaga, right?
Exactly, in Spain. No one else is there at this point, but these are already, to their eyes and the camera crews, now our eyes, the biggest waves that have ever been seen on planet Earth. And CJ's not even yet brother-in-law, Garrett's like, bro, let me tow you out and you can rip some or whatever.
Yeah.
And CJ's like, bet, sick, let's do it. And he does it. And then his whole arc later is like years later when it's time to like compete. And Garrett, and I can't tell if this is legit or not. And Garrett's like, CJ could be among the best in the world if he wanted to be. He doesn't want to be.
No.
Because he's trying to get his body and mind right. And so instead of going to the Nazare Championship, he goes to Peru for 2 weeks in search of, quote, natural medicine, yeah. Which means cramming into a tent and throwing up into a bucket. This guy is my fucking lord. Yes. I just love him. I love his beautiful spirit and energy. I will never, ever know what it's like to be him, but I wish I could just know a little bit. I just admire him and I love him.
Yeah, CJ is really a great character. That's the thing, is that this show just has like so many indelible characters. I mean, like Cadi, like Al Menny, who's the other sort of first surfer that goes out with Garrett. He's from Ireland. It's just awesome. Yeah, so you think that there's going to be more, huh?
200 foot wave, baby. Yeah. No, they are making a second series. I mean, again, I appreciate and respect the way this show is made, because there's a section, and I think it's in the fifth episode, where they talk about how professional surfing doesn't exist unless there are surf photographers and cameramen, right, to tell the story. And that's kind of the tension that probably exists in the minds and the abnormally large necks of all these successful surfers, which is, am I doing this because I love this moment of communion and it's a very private moment? Like, as Garrett says multiple times, he wishes he could just go out and rip these sets, right? Like, he just wants to be doing it. And there must be tons of times where he did, where they weren't being watched or competing. But none of that matters in terms of livelihood or sponsorships or the way they make their money or are able to do this. So this collision between like what they want to be doing and then what we see, all this is to say, every moment of their lives has been filmed for the last, you know, certainly 3 years and clearly for longer. So they must just have more footage. And so it's interesting to watch the show pivot almost from being a spiritual journey of one man mm-hmm. versus one wave to here's the cast of characters of big wave surfing.
Yes.
Here we go.
You know, I just want to end on one note that I had about, you know, one of my favorite parts about this series is the domestic snapshots we get of these people's
Great.
Lives.
Totally.
And, you know, at the end, they're kind of like, and then COVID hit. And you're like, well, that was tough for everybody, you know? And then it's like, cut to incredible drone shot as we come in on Garrett's like dope Oahu estate. And like Nicole is making like sweet potatoes and it's just like, yeah, it's been real challenge being cooped up here. And like CJ is out greeting the day, like inhaling the sea foam. And like all these kids are like paddle boating around at like toddler age. And I'm like, you had a much different pandemic than I did.
Chickens are running into their house.
Yeah. Also, like, I just can't understand if you have that kind of a Oahu pad. I like Portugal a lot when I went.
Yeah.
I liked it.
But it looks like beautiful.
Nazare looks like a small Portuguese fishing village. And it also looks like it's winter 10 and a half months of the year there. It is like up in the North Atlantic.
Yeah.
So it's just sort of wild when you were like, I could just go out and catch these two or three footers in Oahu and then come back and like eat Nicole's cooking and chill.
Because the footage, and we should say this, I mean, it's a beautiful thing to look at. This
it's
whole
amazing.
Series,
and
it's what
Philip
your
Glass
new TVs
music.
Were made for.
Yeah.
It's such a well-done production. That said, it jumps up a level almost without doing anything different when they're in Oahu. I'm like, oh, this is what Technicolor must have felt like when black and white movies ceased to be a thing. Like, it is so vibrant and electric and beautiful and great. And yeah, like, I'd like that life, but maybe that's another piece of it that I think it makes the show so compelling, which is something keeps getting them out of there. Something keeps motivating them to leave paradise. I will say, in the case of CJ, he brings some of that sweet, sweet paradise attitude with him wherever he goes. And I hope he could bless me one day. I mean, I would sign up for that yoga class. And there's just a moment in one episode where he's leading a laughter yoga class.
Yeah, he's like, we have to laugh out all of our trauma.
I mean, okay, sounds
also sounds, something Jewish people don't say.
No, we laugh about it, but it doesn't come out.
It doesn't get anywhere. Yeah,
it stays within. Last question I have for you is, people who know, you know, who listen to this podcast for years know we don't generally dabble in nonfiction programming that's not Top Chef. Mm-hmm. I think we talked about like The Jinx, which was
I watched Survivor
show a couple
yeah.
years ago. And you watched Survivor. But I mean, in terms of like docuseries,
mm-hmm.
is this one particularly unique because of the subject matter, in that every single moment is filmed. I mean, my memory of watching documentaries, or my experience watching documentaries, even expert ones like The Last Dance, which I enjoyed earlier this year, there will be moments when someone narrates something because, of course, a camera wasn't turned on.
Well, they don't have, there's a couple of things that they don't have. Like, they don't have Al and Cotty's like falling out, right?
That's right.
And I feel like there's some stuff that's like, I don't know, there's some domestic stuff that I think gets skipped over a little bit, but.
You mean like Garrett's first family that we
to
never
me,
meet?
It's just like they do a very effective job of being, they have something that like no other documentary seems to have, which is like, we can always cut to these big waves and they're dope. You know, like there are some
so
shows
dope.
That was just like, oh, I got to do a drone shot. Like, here's another flyover of Burbank where we're doing a true crime documentary. And it's like, nah, nobody really gives a shit about watching that. But like, I will just watch those waves crashing against the cliff for hours.
They definitely, last thing, when we first go to Nazaré and they're like, the reason why this is the best and also the worst place on earth is because there are, contrary to these other places, there are 19 man-crushing waves at any moment, and they're coming sideways at you and all pointing you into these rocks.
And because they're, yet, and there's an underwater canyon, so
right,
yeah.
3 miles deep. And yet, being smashed into the rocks immediately is taken off the table as a problem,
yeah.
Which I respect. I don't know how they did that. Chris, you, longtime listeners know, you yourself were a lifeguard. You know,
uh-huh.
You know, I saw you, I don't want to brag, but I saw you in a swimming pool this summer, and you know your way around H2O. You are comfortable and confident. What is your level of like, okay, I could do some of that to, are you fucking kidding me?
Zero percent. I don't love deep ocean stuff. Like
right.
There was like a couple of times when I've been snorkeling and you get really far out there past a reef and you're like, oh, that is eternity. You know, like I cannot contemplate like how deep
right.
and far that is the Pacific Ocean. And like, I will die if I keep going out here. And it, psychologically, more than anything, I just find it terrifying. Those waves would kill us, you know, immediately.
Yes.
Yeah. Like there would not be like, oh, cool. Like I could, like you saw people trying, they were trying to get back onto the beach. There's some harrowing footage in this show where someone's basically trying to get back on the beach and the tide is just like yanking them back out. So like they'll go in on a wave and be 10 feet from the shore. And then the tide just yanks them back out by like 40 yards.
Yeah. And like, even when people have, and that's the other thing, you're towed out there and your choices are, you're either going to surf the best thing you've ever surfed and somehow make it out, or you're going to wipe out. And wiping out doesn't necessarily mean you're going to do, you know, crazy triple backflip in the air and break your back. Even if you just slip off the board or the wave or the whitewater, the barrel overtakes you, then the next part of your journey begins. And like, that's, even the people who are, survive it, are like, there's a moment when Garrett is like, yeah, I saw the whitewater coming, so I was underwater for 40, 50 seconds. Like already, I'm like, this doesn't seem ideal.
Well, that he's like, and he's also like, I get the fear back. That's my thing. Is like, I want to feel like I'm drowning. It makes me
they
feel
talk
alive.
About the fear. God bless these guys. I mean, I think they should just start. Like, Headspace does very well, but I feel like I just need a motivational podcast from these three dudes in
CJ
particular.
Just being like, laugh out the trauma, brother.
Just keep laughing. And Cotty, like, we talk about how they have the footage of everything, but there's a moment in the last episode where Cotty rides the wave of his life and no one saw it. So
yeah,
because
they were
happen?
Filming like a like a terrible accident. Yeah,
it's so existential. It's unreal. Bravo to all involved.
Yeah,
including
awesome
you
show.
For getting me into this. I love it. Check it out. It's such a great watch.
So we'll wrap it up there. We were produced, as always, by Kaya McMullen. We'll be back on Thursday. Until then, take care.
Of the three of us, I think Kaya could surf big waves.
I really think that. I think you're right. Yeah.
I've tried surfing many times in my life and it's never gone well.
It's because those were small waves, Kaya.
Yeah, I know. You have to do big waves.
Fair.
Yeah.